Well, James is all about action. And you certainly can't get through James. Certainly can't read through James. Certainly can't memorize James, wherever you fall in that category, without having an appreciation for the fact that he wants you to do something when you're done with what he's having written to you. But there's something interesting that's also there, and you may not catch this just by a casual read, but the heart of what James is actually getting at is not so much about just about doing, but it is about why we do what we do. Or in other words, you're going to do these actions because of a proper heart that comes about producing that. And that's what really is the core of what James is. Now, this is where we were last week. I'm going to read here very quickly, and I've got one important phrase that I neglected kind of the highlight last week, and it may be one of the most important phrases in this passage, so I'll take a few minutes to go back and emphasize that, and it'll tie into our lesson for today as well. In James chapter 3, my brethren, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment. For we all stumble in many things. If anyone does not stumble in word, he's a perfect man, able also to bridle the whole body. Indeed, we put bits in horses' mouths that they may obey us, and we turn their whole body. Look also at the ships, although they're large and are driven by winds, are turned by a very small rudder. In the next passage, the next portion of this, see how great a forest a little fire kindles, and the tongue is a fire, a whirl of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members, it defiles the whole body, and sets on fire the course of nature, and it's set on fire by hell. For every kind of beast and bird, of reptile and creatures of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by mankind. But no man can tame the tongue. It's an unruly evil, full of deadly poison. And I take it literally when he says no man can tame the tongue. It's absolutely true. You cannot tame it. You can't put a mouth guard over it. You can't put a bridle on your tongue. You can't put some kind of a device on there that's going to tame that thing. Now, you can pierce it, but that's still not going to tame it. You can split it in two, and that's not going to tame it. In order to transform the tongue, you don't work at the tongue. You work at the heart. And the heart produces what comes out of the tongue. It's an unruly evil, full of deadly poisons. With it we bless our God and Father, and with it we curse man, who has been made in the similitude of God. Out of the same mouth proceed this blessing and cursing. It ought not to be. But this one phrase is the thing that I really didn't stress last week, and I want to take a minute to do so, because I think it's important. The importance of this phrase cannot be stressed enough. We've been made in the similitude of God. And this really is the core. It's the core reason why he emphasizes we shouldn't be speaking in these ways to our fellow mankind. It's the very foundation of his reasoning, of his argument, comes out of this statement right here. Why is it that you don't talk poorly to another man? Well, because he's a Christian. Well, because he's a good guy. Well, because he doesn't really deserve it. Has nothing to do with any of that. You could take the foulest of all creatures, well, the foulest of all man, the guy on death row, and it is true that he was made in the similitude of God. And therefore, we ought not to curse man. Now, that doesn't mean we don't say bad things about people in death row. But it does say something about why it is we speak to people the way that we do. I got to use this principle in the last week or so with my own kids. And you know, sometimes, every now and then, it happens that someone may say something unkindly to someone else in the family. And so, you know, I get to say, look, you know, why is it that we shouldn't speak that way to our siblings? It's not because they're perfect, not because they're right all the time, it's not because they're really always wonderful to be around, it's because your sibling was made in the image of God. And that's an important fact, and it goes all the way back to the very beginning, of course, with creation, and follows on with Noah. In Genesis 1:26, God said, let us make man in our image. We know this passage, because this is where it comes from, and he says, let us make him in our likeness, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and all that. And we call this in Latin a very well-known phrase, the Imago Dei. We are in the image of God. And so we bear His image. We are image bearers of God. But it doesn't just stop there. He goes on in multiple passages to talk about this, to refresh our memories of this. This is the book of the genealogy of Adam. In the day that God created man, He made him in the likeness of God. He wants to make sure. If you missed it in Genesis 1, I've got it for you here again. In Genesis chapter 5, He created the male and female. In Genesis chapter 9, whoever sheds man's blood, for by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God He made man. For the Bible believer, the very core, the whole principle, you could say, of capital punishment rests on this statement right here. This covenant of God. Why is it so important that you not take another person's life? Because that person was made in the image of God. And James uses the same argument, not to say don't kill someone, but to say don't kill them with your tongue, if you will. Why? Because they were made in the image of God. We are image bearers. And to do so says you are nothing. And God says, you're saying that's nothing? They bear my image. And that's a really important thing. Now, this, of course, is given. This covenant decree is given as Noah steps down off the boat, you know, lands there. The waters have receded from the flood, puts the rainbow out, and issues this decree. And the decree is tied to the everlasting promise of the rainbow, guaranteeing against a worldwide catastrophic flood. Promise is part of a total covenant, this being the first part of it right here. And if the promise of the rainbow is everlasting, then the rest of this covenant should probably be considered an everlasting covenant as well. Now, this is a really important concept for us to grasp, okay? And so I'm going to take a minute here just to talk about, not to kind of springboard from this, because I think it's important as we look at this passage at all, that we really grasp this notion for interpreting Scripture. It's very important, it's vital, that when you see commands of God in their context, you have to understand to whom, for whom, when they were made, and for how long they are supposed to be kept, and what we're supposed to do as a result of it. Or you look at this passage and you can go, what is this? How do I live my life in light of this passage? Does this passage, this statement, way back in Genesis chapter 9, long time ago in history, does this affect me? Should I live my life in light of this principle whatsoever, or how much and to what extent should I do so? Certainly, we look at covenants in different ways, the different contracts or covenant principles that are recorded in the Bible. There are certain covenants or contracts that have a starting point and have an ending point, the Mosaic Covenant. Now, that's not to say that the Mosaic Covenant doesn't have an effect on us today. You certainly could say that it does. But, you know, Jesus came not to kill the law, not to destroy it, but He came to fulfill it. It was a done deal at the cross. And there's a new covenant that kind of takes its place, if you will. And then there are other covenants that, in some sense at least, are everlasting. They go on as far as time goes on, maybe even beyond. Abrahamic covenant, certain aspects of that we talk about being everlasting. Remember, God promised Abraham land, descendants, and blessings. And He says, Abraham, you're going to get this land. And ultimately, God, I believe, recreates the heavens and earth so that He can provide Abraham the promise that He initially gave him. You're going to get this land? Well, it's going to be land forever, He tells him. Well, if He destroys the world, He's not going to have land anymore. So He recreates the world just to keep His covenant true. And maybe for some other reasons as well. But the Noahic covenant then, is Noahic covenant, well, I've already told you, but does it go on forever and ever? Or does it not? Is this covenant meant to be applied to us today or not? Well, we would say probably it does mean to be applied to us today. Certainly, you can't look at the rainbow and go, well, I'll take that covenant and cut it in two. And I go, well, the good part I like and the bad part I don't like, so the good part is everlasting. The rainbow promise. We tell our kids, look, rainbow, not going to flood. Now, have you ever told your kids that? Come on, you can raise your hand. I know, you won't be considered charismatic if you raise your hand. So you do that, right? But then do you also explain to them, now this is, by the way, that same covenant, rainbow, everlasting promise of God, is the reason why we have capital punishment. Have you gone to that extreme to explain that to your kids as well? Well, probably should. I haven't done it either, I don't think. But so today we'll have a little lesson about that. But this is the very point of it. God made a covenant. The covenant is everlasting, and all aspects of the covenant are everlasting as well. And he says, look, the principle of capital punishment, whether you like it or not, the principle of it is this. God said, man is made in my image. And if you take a man's life, then that man should be taken as well because of the importance, the significance of it. And this covenant doesn't end at any point in time. So when you come to any of the covenants in the Bible, we always have to look and say, what part of this applies to me? Now we'll come back to this one. How do I live my life in light of what he has to say here? Well, certainly, if I see someone killing someone, then I should take their life as well. That's probably not exactly the way it should work out. But we can understand how this plays into the government and all those principles behind that. But how do I live my life in light of this? Well, James makes a good point. He says, look, you're made in the image of God. We are made in the image of God. And we should not therefore kill people with our tongues in light of that. That's a very personal application of this passage to me. 1 Corinthians talks in similar vein. However, the spiritual is not first, but the natural, and afterward the spiritual. The first man was of the earth, talking about Adam, made of dust. The second man, talking about Christ, is the Lord from heaven. As was the man of dust, so also are those who are made of dust. And as is the heavenly man, so are those who are made of heavenly. And as we also have borne the image of the man of dust, we also shall bear the image of the heavenly man. The passage doesn't speak to the image bearing in the same way that we were looking at earlier, but it certainly could be said that it borrows from the concept and maybe even extends it. Where we are image bearers of God in one sense already, you are all in the image of God. All mankind is equally in the image of God, although I would say, some people look a little better than others. But still, we are all in the image of God. We are born again. We'll be image bearers in a different sense someday. There's two senses of the word coming out here. One is the full sense. In fact, you could say in some ways, our images have been distorted by the sin curse. And where someday we will be fully like him, the image distortion goes away, perfect clarity. It's like going from regular TV to HD TV, but even better. And we'll be there someday. But he goes on then in James 3:13, and this really will tie into what we were just talking about. But he goes on to say, who is wise and understanding among you? Now, remember how did the previous passage start out? If you want to be a teacher, be careful, because you'll receive stricter judgment. And then he goes into discussion about the tongue. So what's the whole point of that? Careful what you say. Careful what you want to say. You want to be a teacher? Well, that's fine. You're going to get stricter judgment because what you say is important. And that applies not just to teaching, but in your entire life. Now, kind of in a way, going back to the teaching idea, I think, he's saying, look, there's someone out there that goes, okay, I want to be a teacher. He says, be careful. And by the way, everyone should be careful what they say. And then the guy goes, yeah, well, I still think I'm all right with being a teacher. I think I'm ready for that. I'm wise. I'm understanding. I've got the knowledge. I'm ready and prepared to share that with other people. He says, fine, that's a good thing. Let him show by his good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. Now I'm going to read through here and then we'll come back to it. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom does not, by the way, I don't know if you can see it in the highlights here or not, but the word wisdom is kind of a thing coming out here in this passage a little bit. This wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. But the wisdom that's from above is first pure and then peaceable, then gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy, good fruits, without partiality, without hypocrisy. Let's break this apart a little bit here for a second. It's interesting here. He talks about wisdom, but he also talks about understanding. He says, who is wise and understanding? The word understanding is only used here in the book of James. It's the word episteme. And that doesn't mean much to you in the Greek, but it's the word epistemology. Anyone ever hear that? Yeah, probably not. But epistemology is the study of learning. It's a philosophical, it's a subset of a philosophy. You can take a whole philosophy on learning. And Plato was one to kind of emphasize this concept. In fact, Plato theorized these distinctions. He said, look, there's belief, and there is truth, and where if you draw a circle, truth, and draw a circle, belief, and where those two circles cross, that's understanding or knowledge. That's Plato's idea. You can toss that out or not. But certainly that's the word that he would use, epistemology, episteme. It's this idea of understanding knowledge, the idea of where you really grasp something that comes true. Now, James, of course, he's not writing in a vacuum. He's writing to people who are in the times. They know philosophy is a pretty big deal in these days that he's writing. These sophists are running around, these so-called wise people. And maybe perhaps he's trying to emphasize to some of these folks who think, yeah, okay, I know what I'm talking about. I'd like to be a teacher. I got some knowledge I'd like to share. I'm ready to give it. And he says, look, you think you're wise. You think you know. You've got the knowledge. Good. But make sure of one thing. Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. He's saying, look, if you think you're all that, that you've arrived, that you're ready to show your stuff, then there's a better way than just standing up in front to do it. Remember, the start of the section was a warning against becoming a teacher. And this is a continuation of the same talk. Now, evidently someone there wanted to be a teacher. Evidently someone wanted to teach. And he says, maybe you're doing it with the wrong motive. Be careful, because teachers receive stricter judgment. But what comes out of the mouth comes from the heart. And if you still think you're there, that what you've got is some great wisdom to share with others, then make sure that your actions speak of humility and not boasting. Make sure that people can see it in your actions. So he says, look, are you wise? Are you wise? Then show your works done in meekness of wisdom. Meekness of wisdom, what does that mean? Think about it. Meekness of wisdom, like Austin of Texas, or Eric of Buda. What does that mean? Meekness of wisdom. Well, it's a wisdom that's characterized in this case by meekness. So if you're going to give out this wisdom, make sure that along with it comes meekness. There should be understanding. See, I was prophetic, and I told you this even before it came up. There should be, that comes with this, something that's from the inside, something that's a quality that goes with it that is meek, not showy, not arrogant, not self. Promoting, it should be someone that teaches, should be, you should see in them the meekness that comes out from that. Again, he's going on with the heart stuff. What comes out is what's already there. If there's muck on the inside, then what you're going to get is muck on the outside. And anything that doesn't represent the muck accurately is only a lie against the truth. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, and all that. Meekness. Meekness is a quality of not being overly impressed by a sense of one's self-importance. Not being overly impressed by a sense of one's self-importance. So, I'm learning to get over my own self-importance and express myself in that way. It's not being overly impressed by who I am. Wow, pretty good stuff, man. I did a pretty good job this week. And, it never fails, I think I've told you this before, but It seems like the times when I feel like I really got the good sermon, you know, like this, that was a good one, man. It was really good. And, I was clean and polished, and I was all ready to go, and I really worked through it, and I come down to the end of that thing, and like, man, those people, I really, really gave it to them that time. The Lord was working through me. And I never get any feedback at all on those sermons. Probably the only feedback would be negative. Like, what kind of arrogant person is that? I don't know what you're thinking. But it's when I feel like, man, I'm just stumbling all over myself, and all I can do to stand up here and talk. That's when and probably what's happening, that's when I get the most positive feedback. Now, I realize probably what's happening is people are going, that poor guy, we got to do something to encourage him. So maybe that's what's going on. But nonetheless, the less sure I am of myself, somehow the Lord tends to, it seems to be that he's doing the most. Maybe that's the way it's supposed to be. But notice he doesn't mince words here. If you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, don't boast against the truth. This wisdom does not come from above, but it's earthly, sensual, demonic. He doesn't exactly mince words here. It's something ironic about this passage, this portion of the passage. It says, look, you've got to express your wisdom and your knowledge and your understanding in meekness. And then the next phrase out of his mouth is, anything that doesn't conform to that is demonic! Straight out of the pits of hell! Now that doesn't sound very meek, if you ask me. But that's because we sometimes understand meekness in the wrong way. If you're going to speak, if you're going to teach, if you're just going to plain act, make sure you do so with meekness. And oh, by the way, here's some meekness for you. You're acting like the devil straight from the pits of hell. Meekness doesn't always mean softness, doesn't always mean cheerfulness, doesn't always mean easily pushed over. In fact, it probably rarely means that. James, in his very direct statements, neither contradicts himself nor is he hypocritical in his actions. Because you have to understand, of course, meekness is not being overly fulfilled by your own greatness. There's a wisdom here that is a falsehood, is a relatively mild kind of evil. Well, not relatively mild at all, really. It's not from above. It's earthly. It's sensual. It's demonic. And it's likened to envy, self-seeking, and producing confusion and every kind of evil thing. So, are you wise? Then make sure you show that your works are done in meekness of wisdom. If you've got wisdom, you've got understanding, make sure that you're not full of yourself and overly enthused by that. And then thirdly, the wisdom of falsehood is not a relatively mild kind of evil, but rather is full of the worst kind of representation that it can have. The true wisdom, however, that's of above, is pure and peaceable and gentle and willing to yield and full of mercy and lots of good fruit. No partiality, no hypocrisy, and all that. So what does real wisdom, the spiritual wisdom, godly wisdom look like? Well, it's not boastful. It's not arrogant. Quite the opposite. And we'll do a little short word study of these in just a moment. But first, I wanted you to see something. That word right there, now, in verse 18. Now the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. In verse 17, it says, but. And that's the Greek word de, or delta epsilon. And then in verse 18, it's the same word. Now, again, you know, you can't always blame the translators for not being consistent, but they really would do themselves a service, I think, by being a little more consistent in this. It would help us to see something here. There's a continuation of contrast going on. Day can be translated appropriately, depending on the context, as either but, and, also, now, as they've done it here in verse 18. But if you're going to do it, let's keep it consistent. And as you'll see, when we get done with James, I'm going to do a little diagram for you that kind of shows you the whole thing. But the word day, or but, is kind of forms a framework for the whole book of James. He uses this over and over and over again to start new sections, or to continue on in a section and to prove the same point over and over again. This is a parallel clause. And he's saying, look, There is this self-seeking confusion and envy that comes from this false wisdom. There's this fake form of it. There's this self-conceived notion of wisdom that you have to give. There's something that comes from the yuckiness, the muckiness of yourself. This is what that looks like. And then we're going to contrast it with something else. But the wisdom that's from above does this. And then also, but, same word again, but the fruit of righteousness. So here's the contrast. There's my wisdom that looks like this, not very pretty, but the wisdom from above looks like this. And also, but, same contrast to this thing, but the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. So here's what I produce out of myself. Here's what I produce, or what God produces through me when it's in proper alignment. All right? And we'll come back to the details of that next week. But I just wanted you to see the importance of that. It forms a nice little framework. But let's go back and do a little word study here. And this is not going to be any great spiritual upheaval, but I hope that you'll get some benefit out of this, seeing the context of each one of these words. And if nothing else, I want you to see one thing that comes out of this thing, and that's a great contrast between the now, or between the here and the there. And that's the whole point of this. This wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly. Earthly is literally on the earth, literally land. It is epi. Epi is on, and the word for earth. And it emphasizes the physical, the temporal nature of the thing. It's in stark contrast to the heavenly. It's a wisdom that's planted on the ground. It can't fly. It faces all the limitations and frailties of a physical form. It's earthly by itself is neither negative nor positive word. You know, something's on the earth. That doesn't make it a bad thing by itself. But it's always used in contrast to the alternative, and thus in the context takes on a harsher sense. First, this four times in the Bible. And here it's used, for example, there are also celestial bodies and terrestrial bodies. You've got two different kinds of things. Contrast. In 2 Corinthians, we know that our earthly house is one shape. We know that our heavenly house is another. Earthly house is not necessarily sinful or evil. That's not the point of this passage in 2 Corinthians, but it's temporary. It falls apart. It dissolves. You know, I mean, for those of you that are older than Colleen and I, you don't have any pity on us, but we're starting to realize a little bit about how it is falling apart. And, you know, it's just not the way it was 10 years ago. And I'm sure it'll get worse. But, you know, we can look forward to sitting on the front porch and getting old together. Or not. But, I'm sorry, back up. So it's used in this sense of contrast between that which is heavenly, that which is earthly, that which is temporal, that which is eternal, that which is lasting, that which is not. The second word is sensual. Now, this is probably a really bad translation, because when you think of the word sensual, you think of the word sexual, you think of the word sensual in the worst possible sense of the word. The word sensual is really almost neutral, like the word earthly in its core. It's something of the senses, is literally the word. It's sensual, sensual is probably a better translation, but that's not a real word. But it is the actual Greek word is psychē, or from which we get the word psyche, or it's also the word we get the word psychic. It's actually the most specific transliteration of that. Now, if I said it is earthly, it is psychic, then you go, oh, well, there it is again, another negative word. Could you think about the guys you drive down I-35, and there's the sign of the guys where they read your fortunes or something, the psychics. Well, psychic, too, originally didn't have that such a negative connotation. It was literally just of the psyche, of the soul, which is contrasting what? The spiritual. Again, it's in its form, in its essence, the word itself is neutral. It really has no negative connotation by itself. You always got to put it in the context. Now, when you put it in the context, what's he saying? It's in contrast to what? The spiritual. The heavenly. That which is above. That which is better. So, this is something you really got to get. Earthly, that's not a bad thing by itself. Psychic or psuche or sensual or sensical, whatever. That's not a bad thing either. But what makes it so bad is it, in contrast to that which is above, right? So you got to see the contrast of this. Pertaining to the life of the natural world and whatever belongs to it in contrast to the realm of experience, whose central characteristic is pneuma. It is natural, it's unspiritual, it's worldly. Essential in the sense of sense of the word. It's used here, though, in Jude chapter 1, only one chapter. They're grumblers and complainers that walk according to their own lust and their mouth, great swelling words, etc. These are sensual persons who cause division, not having the Spirit. Again, in Jude, really sensual is probably not the best way to translate it, because again, we think of the sexual connotation. But it is of the senses. Their emphasis is on their own self, what is here now, as opposed to that which is above and a much higher place of being. You could say instead of being spiritual, it's soulful. Certainly we understand by the larger context of the rest of Scripture, this is a derogatory use of the word in a sense, but it's better to see it in terms of contrast, what we do and what we do here and now. What we do, think, and how we proceed, the wisdom that we draw from, that we live by, that we present, can easily be in and of itself neutral. In fact, every day we make wisdom choices that are basically neutral. You go to Starbucks and you go, oh man, I got to make a choice. And that's going to be, is it going to be the venti cup or the, you know, why can't they just say large and medium? I don't know why. But, you know, which cup is it going to be? And then which flavor of coffee am I going to get? You got to make some kind of those are neutral choices, right? Now, obviously, you know, you get all those frou-frou flavors. That's more sensual because it has more senses. Therefore, it must be more sinful. I just get the black coffee, you know, and I put some sugar in it. So I'm much more spiritual. But nonetheless, if you can't be like me, then, well, you make decisions every day that are somewhat neutral. Some of you make decisions that are affect millions of dollars, ultimately thousands of jobs, and certainly they're not light or unimportant choices, but they don't necessarily in and of themselves have a loftier purpose, and they will in the end dissolve away, right? You may make choices that, I mean, you know, I for the last 3-4 months I've been trying to get this project done, and I fell behind, you know, and I made some choices about order of precedence of things that I was doing in my programming. And ultimately you could say, well, maybe because I didn't get it out, you know, 3 months earlier, well, now, you know, these $6-7 million worth of investments, everyone's just going, it's done deal, and everyone's going to walk away, and you know, I'm out of a job, and now we're doing something different. So, you know, even in my little realm of the world, I'm affecting, you know, millions of dollars worth of choices. But in the end, even if I'd, you know, made different choices and maybe we'd still be existing, who knows? Probably not. But in the end, not going to make any difference. That doesn't mean I shouldn't make better choices. But demonic. This is a hapax legomenoi. That's just a word that only appears one time in the Bible. And you would think the word would appear more times than that, but now the derivative or the source of this word for demon appears many times. But it's literally, again, this is not inherently an evil word. You see the word demon and you go, now that's an evil word. Now you could say, Eric can maybe make a claim that earthly is not evil, and maybe sensual, if we'll give him that maybe, but demonic, clearly, that's just terrible word right there. Well, certainly in its use in the New Testament, it came to be almost entirely used of someone that's possessed by a demon or controlled by ultimately by the devil or what have you. But the word itself just means something of the lower earth, lower spirit world. And in the writings of the day, someone would say the word demon, they don't automatically think about, you know, evil spirits and all that, which we think about because we have the rest of the New Testament. We've listened, we've read it, we've seen the stories. But in that day and age, they wouldn't necessarily think the worst about these things. They maybe should have been, but they were much more neutral in their thinking, right? James is using words specifically. He's pulling words out of the hat, and he's not making a mistake on the words he's choosing. He's not choosing the very worst words he could use. He could have used the word satanic here. There'd be no question about that one. He could have used the word, instead of sensual, which is really just a very neutral word about senses, he could use a word far harsher than that. He didn't use those words. Why? Because he doesn't want you to get stuck on what it is that's coming out is being so bad. We go, that guy, he's bad. Because I can clearly see what he's got is bad. Now, that's not the point. I can stand up here and I can spout off stuff that sounds good all day long. But if my heart is not right, you may not even see it. You may never know. But the Lord does. Great contrast between who I am and the Lord. The great contrast between what other people are and the Lord. And hopefully, I'm not operating out of the false realm and trying to deceive. That's not my intention. But you never know. And you have to be careful. And his point is not to say, look at the people that are sailors with a foul mouth where you can clearly see it. Be careful, because there's people out there that look good, wonderful, clean, but when you compare them to the truth, then there should be a distinction that's made from that. And maybe we should be able to see it as well. All right. This is a wisdom that produces something. Now, back up. He said in verse 14, if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, blah, 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 this wisdom does not descend from above. For where envy and self-seeking, same words, exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. So in other words, he's saying, if you've got the envy and self-seeking, it's going to produce something from that which is not from above, that which is from the earthly realm, that which is of the senses, that which is base and not heavenly. And where this kind of thinking comes from, it produces something. It does something. Yeah, sorry about the arrows. I left them in on accident. This word for envy is the Greek word zealous. Now, two English words come from that word, interestingly enough. The word zeal or zealous, like you're a zealot, but also you can sometimes the Z's in Greek will transform into a J, and you get the word jealous. And so it's interesting that in the Greek, this word can also be used in both senses of zealous and jealous. And you have to look at the context as to which one of these is being used. And it's used in a positive sense in many passages where you say, "I know your zeal for the Lord," and that's this word here. But also he says in lots and lots and lots of negative passages, you have got this bitter envy and jealousy. And in 1 Corinthians, for you are still carnal. For where there is envy, that's this word for zealous, strife and divisions among you, are you not carnal and behaving like mere men? Definitely not a positive statement he's making here. So again, you've got to look at the context and see how these words are being used to understand their true meaning. But in this case, this is intense negative feelings over another's achievements or success. Zealousness can easily transform into jealousness if you're not careful. And that's why you can use the same word in the same way. You have zeal for something. And then you go, well, I really like that thing to be just that way. And if someone else is going to get it, then now I'm jealous. And so we easily transform from one thing into the next. Self-seeking. The root meaning is simply to work for daily hire. Again, it's not an inherently evil word. Working for daily hire is not a bad thing. But it eventually came to derive something of self-seeking pursuit, political office, by unfair means. The word implies a rivalry, including a sense of hostility and strife. Again, one more time, the word itself can certainly have a neutral meaning, but put into context, stark contrast, we see the intention of the term. James masterfully makes the case not by pointing out the worst potentials of humanity, but instead stresses more of the base nature of it, the neutral aspects that when compared to their counterpart Only then do we see how truly low they are. Look, if you live your life every day with no view toward heaven, you may perhaps scoop by without being overtly sinful. Someone may, you know, you don't do things that everyone goes, that's the guy you got to stay away from. But don't compare yourself with how bad you could be. On the contrary, we must look at the standard, which is heaven. And by doing so, only then will we know when we truly fall short. Romans chapter 2. Those who are self-seeking. 2 Corinthians 12 uses the same word there. Outbursts of wrath. Selfish ambition. In Galatians, it uses the same word. Selfish ambitions. It uses in these very negative senses of the word. Here's one commentator or one dictionary lexicon had this to say about the word. For many, it probably had no more than the general sense of baseness, self-interest, and contention. In Romans 2, verse 8, which we saw just spattering up there, it's clearly contention or strife is rather too specialized. And we do best to see a reference to the despicable nature of those who do not strive after glory, honor, and immortality by perseverance and good works, but who think only of immediate gain. This meaning is equally applicable in these other passages. It's better than strife or contention, as in Philippians chapter 2. For this reason, it is best to understand apatheia as base self-seeking, or simply as baseness, the nature of whose nature of those who cannot lift their gaze to higher things. And that's what I want you to see right there. What he's making a contrast here is you got that which is down here and that which is up there. And don't get fixated on that which is down here being so bad. It's when you compare it to that which is up there when you really see it. Confusion, unsettled state of affairs, disturbance, tumult, opposition to established authority, disorder, unruliness. And this is what it produces ultimately. It's used in Luke, but when you hear of wars and commotions, do not be terrified. For God is not the author of confusion, but of peace. There's the great contrast being brought out again. And then finally, in the negative sense, he says there's confusion, but also every evil thing. Evil is an interesting word as well. In both English and the Greek, it's likely that the word came from the word for foul, which is most likely an onomatopoeia, which is foul. Kind of hear the sound in that. It's stinky. This is the beyond base. This is substandard. This is when you're going through the muck and it smells. It's stinkiness. And it's every kind of stinkiness is there that it produces. So here's what we got. You want to be a teacher? Be careful. Greater judgment. Not just the teachers, though. Everyone be careful, because what comes out of the mouth is produced from the heart. And if you think you've passed the test, you think you've got some wisdom, something to share, make sure that your life expands upon not producing for your own benefit, but from meekness of wisdom, wise meekness, so that people can see the truth. That is contrasting from above versus that which is below. The wisdom from below is base. It's of the senses. It is foul. It is, and this same envy and the same self-seeking produces wisdom that looks like this, and it produces a confusion and an evil thing that will be there. Evil, 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 bad. It's spoken of in these different passages. So we have earthly, of the earth, grounded, base, sensual, psychic, physical, non-spiritual, base, demonic, is from the lower parts. Again, base, and envy and self-seeking, a zeal for the self, a working for the man, for yourself. And it produces pandemonium, disorder, a lowly, stinky, foul base. So what you have then in the beginning of this is something that is this, and that produces that which is below. It looks like this. Envy and self-seeking looks like this, and it produces confusion and evil. So here's the contrast. There's earthly wisdom that's described. It's wisdom that's not from above. And then there's the godly wisdom that is from above. There's the godly wisdom that's pure. It's an attribute of the divinity and everything belonging to it. It's innocent. That which awakens religious awe. There's a picture there of someone looking at that and going, wow, awe. And when you think of awe, you think of looking up and seeing that which is above. In civic life, it was used as a term of honor denoting the blameless discharge of an office. It's peaceable. It's root, the word, root of this word, by the word, the name Irene is the word peace. The root of this word is principally, does not denote a relationship or an attitude, but a state. It's an interlude in the everlasting state of war. In the New Testament, it's used of a normal state of all things, and the eschatological salvation of man, and the peace of God, peace of the soul, peace of man with one another. But it is a state of being. It is gentle. It is not insisting on every right of letter of law of custom. It is yielding. It is kind. It is courteous. It is tolerant. It is willing to yield. It is compliant. It's obedient. It's easily persuaded. It's submissive. It's reasonable. It's open to reason. It is by extension able to discuss a differing point of view without making offense. It's to do something someone else's point away, even if it's not the best way to do it. And sometimes that's difficult. It is full of mercy. It is eleos. It is kindness. It's a concern for express of someone else's need. It is not impartiality. It is not adikia. And by the way, the Greek word for righteousness is diakosune. This is the adiak. So in other words, it's the opposite of righteousness. It is not. It is a violator of the law. It's not a violator of the law. It's not in the vilest sense. It's not a violator of divine law in the New Testament. It's not an unjust nature of action. This is an unrighteous action towards others, and this wisdom that's from above does not act this way. It is not with hypocrisy. It's what it says it does. There's no two faces. There's no mask changing. There's no character infringement. It's genuine. It is sincere. It is likened to Colossians chapter 3, where he says, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on, and I like the NET translation here, they say, clothe yourself in. There's a picture of actually wrapping yourself in this thing of mercies, of kindness, of humility, of meekness, of long-suffering, of bearing with one another, forgiving one another. And if anyone has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, do the same. But above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection. Let the peace of God rule in your hearts, to which also you were called in one body, and be thankful. And let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. See, it's interesting parallel. There's a lot of parallels between these two passages, because here again he brings up teaching in this one. Paul's talking about it. Look, if you're going to teach, then teach one another. And do it how? In psalms and hymns and spiritual songs with grace. So again, there's a base way of doing things and there's a lofty way. As the children of God, we're called to be peacemakers. The result of this thing is, now the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Clearly, that doesn't mean just saying nice things to people, right? I mean, James says, well, this is base, it's demonic, it's sensual, and while we may take that as a little harsher than he intended it, still, these are not just flowery words that he's issuing to these people. So it's not just saying nice things to people all the time, but yet we are called to be peacemakers. It does not. We need to have a higher perspective about it. Its goals are lofty. It's lifting the eyes of others towards heaven. There's a fruit of righteousness that comes from this, and it contrasts strongly the next chapter, which is what we'll get into, where he says, the very next phrase, where do wars and conflicts come from among you? Do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? So James says, watch what you say. Your tongue is a powerful tool. You think you're ready to expound on wisdom? Well, here's what heavenly wisdom looks like. So what you have to say comes from your heart, and how you act comes from your heart. Personal wars, well, they come from your heart too. And so what you got, if you got personal wars, if you got no peace, if you've got these things which are characterizing that which is from below, then what you got is a heart issue. And you got to fix the heart if you're going to fix the problem. And that's all there is to it. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for your grace. Thank you for your word. Thank you for the transforming power of your word. Thank you for the wisdom that is from above, that we can tap into, that we can draw from, that we can live by, that we can demonstrate, that we can express and expound upon. I pray that you would help us to reflect those things which glorify you, that others may see you in us and our actions, that our actions would be with a meek wisdom, a wisdom that is characterized by meekness, and that they would be in awe of you through our actions, not because of our greatness, but because of our willingness to yield and to give and not to put ourselves first, that they would see you through that. And even as we approach this week, we'll be around our relatives and friends and whatnot as we travel, that you would protect us, that you would guide us, that you would help us to reflect on you as we encounter those that are around us. And I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.